Good morning and welcome to the December 9th, 2024 edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, on this crisp morning. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger.
Thanks for being here. Today on Mountain Money, we're going to kick off our show with an eye-opening interview with Atossa Araxia Ibrahimian. She's the author of the book, The Hidden Globe, A Jaunt into the World of the International Super Wealthy and How They Are Accommodated on a Global Level.
Then we'll chat with local sisters Rebecca and Stephanie Roberts, owners of a concierge moving business, WP Moving and Logistics, about the care they put into moving your precious items. We'll finish our hour by speaking with chef and partner of Tupelo, Matthew Harris, about his recent The Today Show appearance.
All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. We're used to thinking of a world that is defined by nation states, by lines on a map that separate countries into nations with independent governments, laws, currencies, and legal systems. But there's a parallel world of extraterritorial zones that exists and largely serve the interests of the rich and powerful. Author Atossa Ibrahimian gives a tour of this not-so-unusual world in her new book, The Hidden Globe, How Wealth Hacks the World. We're lucky to be joined by her this morning, and I hope she does not resent my mispronunciation of her name. Good morning, Atossa, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. I should have put a pronunciation guide in the first page. It's Atossa Araxia Ibrahimian, but I'll forgive you.
Okay, excellent. So, Atossa, what motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take to do the research?
So I grew up in a place called Geneva, Switzerland, which on the surface is a very staid and boring place. But if you look beneath the surface, it contains all kinds of small jurisdictions, secrets, different systems of law that apply to people depending on their nationality, their wealth, and what they're doing professionally. So I was inspired by this, having left Geneva and going back and rediscovering my hometown. And, you know, you could say that it took me my whole life, but beginning to end, it took me about 4 or 5 years of research and writing to finish the project.
So let's talk about Geneva. You begin the book in Geneva, where you grew up, and I want you to sort of try to explain a little bit about how Geneva and Switzerland are emblematic of this parallel world, you know, how and why did it develop that way in Geneva in particular?
Sure. So a lot of the book talks about the ways that countries, not always big, powerful countries, sometimes small countries with not a lot of resources, leverage their status as a nation to make money. And I begin the story in Switzerland in like the 1200s, because Switzerland was an early pioneer of this business model. What they became famous for worldwide was training and sending mercenaries to help neighboring monarchs win wars. And these people had no skin in the game. They were just, you know, doing a job and coming back. So I draw a connection between this early pioneering mercenary trade and Switzerland's later eagerness to create laws and spaces and regulations to, again, serve neighboring wealthy people, international dictators, all kinds of people who'd want to use Switzerland, which is neutral, by the way, and helps, to preserve their wealth, often outside of their own country's borders.
So let's dig that down a little bit deeper. We're talking about the notion of essentially selling your status as a country. And what does that mean? And for example, you talk a lot about free ports. How are free ports an example of that?
A free port is a piece of land that's cordoned off. It is within a nation's borders, but different rules apply. In the case of industrial free ports, known as special economic zones or export processing zones, these rules can include labor, they can include immigration, and almost all the time, free ports are exempt from various customs and tariff regulations. So something that goes into the free port is not considered an import the same way that it would be considered if you shipped it to a regular Amazon warehouse or your home. So customs duties might not apply. The free port that I talk about in Geneva, that there are also global versions of this, is a warehouse. Not a lot of manufacturing goes on. In fact, there isn't any at all in Geneva. Rather, this is a place where the international ultra-rich go to store their, it's their mini storage. Except instead of having a bunch of junk and, you know, an extra bed frame and what have you, they're there to store their Picassos or their crates of wine or their gold bars or all kinds of expensive things that they might want to preserve for a long time or keep out of the sight of the tax man.
Sounds like a Gabriel Allon, Daniel Silva novel, because it probably, you know, it very much is like that. So let's go through why I would want to do that. I am a super wealthy guy, I wish, and I have purchased a Picasso or a nice piece of artwork. Why do I want to stash it in this Freeport? What is that keeping me from having to do?
So there are several reasons you do that, and it depends on which Freeport you choose, because each one is a special snowflake, has its own particularities and perks. But broadly speaking, one reason would be secrecy. Maybe you are going through a divorce and you don't want to declare all of your assets to your ex. That's a great place to do that. Another reason could be taxes. Depending on where you are and who you are, your purchase, or if you resell this piece of art, could incur a sales tax, for example. But if you do it within the four walls of the Freeport, you're maybe going to get around that, right? Depending if you play your cards right. There's a really banal reason, which is that many of these Freeports are just tricked out, super safe, climate controlled, you name it. And so your Picasso is going to enjoy a long life behind these walls. But the flip side is that nobody's going to look at it, right? Yeah. And what is art if not for us to admire?
And some of it could be stolen even.
Yeah, it could be stolen from your house, could be stolen from your yacht. But at the Freeport, you know, it depends on which one you're in. But the ones that I'm aware of have unbelievably secure systems to make sure nobody gets in. I went to one that where I had to get my eyeballs scanned just to go through the door.
Now, how is Switzerland making money through this? Because obviously there's a motivation. Countries do this for a reason that's probably not all that, you know, altruistic.
Sure. So Switzerland has developed a reputation for this sort of thing over a long time. And so it's already a go-to place for investment, for, you know, private money, wealth management. But if a smaller upstart, if another country might decide to go this route, right, figure out a way to use its sovereignty to make money, it could go any number of ways. This can take the form of a country creating special postage stamps that stamp collectors will buy for a lot of money. Just because this is something that countries can do that normal people can't just create a postage stamp, right? This is why you end up with a Burkina Faso putting Elvis Presley on a postage stamp. It's just an easy way to make money. Countries might pass laws accommodating cryptocurrency industries or sell flags for ships that allow the ship owners to get around various environmental protections or labor laws. There is a thriving market for flags for shipping that sometimes it's even landlocked countries that are renting out their sovereignty, their flag, to ships to use on the high seas, because that's how the high seas are governed on vessels. So the possibilities are endless. If you're an enterprising nation that wants to get in on this, really the sky's the limit, or even further. You know, you could even pass laws for outer space. And I have a chapter in the book that talks about how Luxembourg did just that.
You do. And we were going to, you took us right to one of the next ports we were going to sail into, which is talking about Luxembourg and space. What are they doing and how are they making money?
So this is one of my favorite things to talk about the book. Luxembourg is a close cousin of Switzerland, right? They have a history of accommodating private wealth from abroad. It's likewise a small country that had a steel industry, but that sort of collapsed at the beginning of the century, and they had to find new ways to stay afloat. So some of that was creating incentives for companies to come and, you know, pay less in value-added tax, for example, in Europe. They created a structure that allowed foreign account holders to kind of shield their wealth through these trusts. And that created a lot of bad press, right? Luxembourg was kind of seen as a little sketchy for a time, especially among its European peers. So it totally changed the conversation and decided to pass a law that recognizes private property in outer space. This is interesting because outer space is governed by no nation, right? There are treaties governing outer space that were signed at the UN. But when these treaties were signed, they did not really stipulate what happens to wealth in space. So if you're an asteroid miner, you go to an asteroid, you drill down, you find some gold. This is hypothetical, but not entirely, right? Yeah. This could happen. You need a country to recognize that that wealth belongs to you, and then to allow you to sell it and to transact with it and turn it into something of value, right? Because if it's floating around out there and no one recognizes that it is even property, like, what's the point? So Luxembourg moved to pass a law, the most broad-ranging of all space laws, to recognize these sorts of things for anybody who has a company in Luxembourg. What does that do? Well, it brings a lot of space companies to Luxembourg. Luxembourg was also offering funding and other programs to actually develop this into an industry, right? So it's not just mailboxes for Elon Musk and his buddies, but it was really successful. I mean, this program was a hit. They have, you know, space conferences all the time, and they're even talking about, you know, creating a bit more of a space program to actually go out to outer space. But for now, this is mostly a commercial enterprise.
Gotcha. And now what about satellite paths?
Yeah, this didn't come out of nowhere. Luxembourg was also a pioneer in privatizing the airwaves in Europe when radio was entirely public, and then sort of graduated to getting into the satellite industry. And it because it was willing to privatize communications, it built up its satellite industry as a sort of precursor to this Space Resources Act.
Can you tell us a little bit about what charter cities are?
Charter cities are very controversial. So the origin of the term charter city comes from an economist named Paul Romer. He's very well-known, brilliant economist who won the Nobel Prize. And in the early 2000s, Paul Romer had been working on the effect of importing ideas into economies and the effect that ideas have in economic growth. And it occurred to him that laws were not unlike ideas in that they weren't finite. You can share them, you can bring them to other countries. And so if you are a country that is suffering from a lack of good laws, so if you don't have the laws that businesses trust and want to work with, you're in trouble because you're not going to attract industry to your nation. So Romer floated this idea, and I'm super oversimplifying. What if we borrowed laws from a country like Canada and plopped them down in a state like Madagascar and encouraged industry and business to operate using this incentive, right? Thinking there's nothing that keeps a law stuck in one place. There's nothing that keeps Canadian law stuck in Canada. So why don't we spread the wealth in that sense? This is a way of thinking about economics and law that assumes that a good law will create, you know, more industry and more economic growth. But it also sounds a bit like colonialism, right? Like taking another country's law and like sending it to a less developed state, and you know, it's not a great look. And so there was a big backlash to this concept of a charter city. The charter city being the poorer country that's borrowing the laws. This has evolved over time. So Paul Romer is no longer part of this conversation. He's distanced himself from it. These days, if you say charter city, the associations are more with a sort of libertarian corporatist philosophy, which is that, you know, this country might have crummy laws. Let's bring in a corporation to run the show instead.
Wow. Yeesh. And now, how many charter cities would you say there are around the world that you know of?
Well, there's one in Honduras that is likewise extremely controversial. In fact, it's in the middle of some pretty big time international litigation. To make a long story short, the Honduran Supreme Court passed a law allowing for these very, very devolved autonomous zones that are essentially controlled by a board appointed by a private company. There was one that was built on the island of Roatan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they broke ground, they made some buildings, they had some events there. But a new government came in 2022, and they've been very against this project. So these investors that are mostly American are suing the state of Honduras for, you know, depriving them of future profits. It's an absurd sum. It's more than $10 billion. Honduras is not a wealthy nation. So unclear what's going to happen with this, but there are some very passionate people on both sides.
So we've been touching on a concept where I take a city in a third world country, for example, and say I'm going to import laws from another jurisdiction. There's a related concept that I thought was really interesting where you talk about Mark Beer and the concept, the legal innovations associated with the Dubai International Financial Center. Let's talk about what that is and what Beer did.
Yeah, so Dubai is a city in the United Arab Emirates. It's referred to as a city-state because it governs a lot of its own affairs. And for years and years, Dubai had its legal system that was just the Dubai legal system. As part of its economic development program, Dubai made a point of carving out free zones, like the ones we talked about before, with rules that are sort of custom made to attract certain types of business. So there's a commodities zone, there's a media zone, there's a finance zone. And in the finance zone, the people, the architects of this zone, both the physical architects and the sort of legal architects, realized that to get the big banks and trading desks and, you know, other financial institutions, they were going to have to create a court where these people felt comfortable taking their case. This is partly because the Dubai courts are in Arabic. They were based on civil law and Islamic law, not really legal systems that, you know, an accountant trained in London or in the US is going to be familiar with. Right. So that was the pitch. We're going to create a set, a legal system that your people are going to just be able to drop in and function in. And they did that. They create. So Dubai has three courts, and then they just added on this court in a free zone on top of it all to sort of supplement. Now, the cases themselves, you know, there's nothing super dramatic going on there. It's normal contractual disputes and workplace stuff. But what it does do is it creates a parallel legal system for businesses and mostly foreign businesses. There's no limit on who, you know, who can buy in, who can opt into this court system. But it is distinct from the Emirati one. And it's a very unusual way of doing things. But I think that it's catching on in other free zones around the world. The architect of the DIFC courts, or the, I guess the big promoter of it, is a man named Mark Beer. He's a British lawyer. He took this idea to Kazakhstan, which has gotten behind it. So I expect to see a lot more of these in the future.
And what was interesting to me, and maybe I didn't understand it, but as I was reading it, was this notion that it's almost like a private arbitration service, in the sense that parties who really don't have a lot to do with Dubai can opt into using this court to get binding rulings. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, binding to a point. They've made deals with a bunch of other jurisdictions to enforce the judgments. I don't think it's everywhere. But if you and I got into some business dispute, before we got into the dispute, we could choose to have our case heard at the DIFC court. And we have nothing to do with this place at all.
Right. And you also had an interesting section where you talked about the notion that litigation about the DIFC itself, there's been some controversy about where that would be litigated, whether that would be litigated in the UAE courts as opposed to the DIFC. I thought that was, I was a little confused by it, but I thought it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, they had a curious case involving the construction of one of the structures in the DIFC. It's called the gate. It's this big gate, you know, looks like a bunch of gray Legos. And this gate was kind of falling apart, and it, you know, some plastic, I think some bricks fell down and could have hurt somebody. And the question was, this is entirely within the physical jurisdiction of the DIFC, right? Shouldn't this case be heard in the DIFC court? And there was some back and forth about whether this would be the case, because there was a party saying, well, it should go to the Dubai court. So nothing that you can't take anything for granted is the upside.
So it's the Wild West, in a way.
Highly regulated Wild West with lots and lots of rules.
But better rules than if you were outside the city of Dubai.
If you're a business, yeah. If you're a business, I think you have every reason to sign up for this set of laws, yeah.
So, there's an underlying theme here that we may not have brought out well enough, and that really is the way all this is just oriented to attract, you know, international business and wealth. That wealth is finding its way to sort of work around traditional country boundaries and legal structures. Let's talk a little bit about one that wasn't really directly on wealth. You talked about the concept of state-free zones and how it's applied to issues of migration in places like Haiti and Australia.
Yeah, something I really wanted to a point that I really wanted to make is that the flip side of sending wealth offshore to places where it was protected and you know, maybe one tax authority can't get into its business, the secrecy and the sort of protection that wealth enjoys offshore, the flip side of that is that these offshore structures and offshore places are also used to send people away. So in the 1990s, when there were large numbers of Haitian citizens leaving Haiti because of instability, many of these people wound up on Guantanamo Bay. This is before Gitmo was, a site for the war on terror. This was a migrant detention camp. And it was useful for the U.S. because they could argue that constitutional rights didn't apply on Guantanamo. Because Guantanamo Bay is a U.S. naval base on a piece of land that is leased from the Cubans, but not the Cubans aren't into this. They're not cashing the checks, but it's technically being leased from the Cubans. It's not U.S. territory. So you can say, well, U.S. laws don't apply, and we can treat people with much less due process here than we would at home. We can also prevent them from applying for asylum from this place, right? And in that way, reduce migration. We saw a very similar thing happen in Australia more recently in 2010s, where they were sort of systematically sending asylum seekers who had arrived by boat to Australia, turning them around and sending them to two prison camps in Nauru, which is a sovereign nation, and Manus Island, which is part of Papua New Guinea, and similarly sending them offshore and depriving them of rights that they would probably enjoy in Australia proper by claiming this is some other country, it's not our problem, right? So this impulse to offshore and to evade responsibility, it applies for humans, which is tragic, tragic stories coming out of Nauru and Manus. And it applies for wealth too. If you put money or industry or, your gold bars in this cordon off area, a different set of rules apply.
As I was reading this section of the book, one of the things that just jumped out at me was that, if I understood this properly, there were islands, I think one of them called Christmas Island, as a matter of fact, off Australia, that they decided was no longer part of Australia, at least for the purposes of holding migrants. That seems like a pretty extraordinary step.
Yeah, and that's exactly like a Freeport, right? If you say this is a place on our land, but the customs rules don't apply, right? You're not paying duties or tariffs. It's a different system. You can see this logic play out by saying, well, this port where the boats tend to arrive on our land, actually, it's not Australia for the purposes of migration. So we're gonna exempt you from the due process that you would enjoy otherwise. And I mean, imagine if someone did that into Florida or Texas and just said, well, this is not part of the U.S. anymore for migration purposes. That's pretty wild.
I wouldn't put it past them, but that's neither here nor there.
Now, I looked for Nauru in Google Maps. I couldn't find it. Where is it?
It's in the Pacific. Yeah. It's quite remote, at least from our perspective. But it is, since 68, I believe, has been a self-governing sovereign nation. Before that, it went through a bunch of different international statuses. It was a protectorate. It was a trust territory. For a while, it was essentially run by a German phosphate industry. And this is a place that throughout its entire history, I mean, it's small. It doesn't have a lot of people. It doesn't have a lot of people to do things, to create industry. But it was very rich in phosphate, which is used for fertilizer. Phosphate, a.k.a. guano, a.k.a. bird poop. And that's why the foreign companies in the beginning of the 20th century came in and essentially strip mined Nauru for completely. Somebody I knew went there, said it looked like the moon. It had been mined so much. And Nauru ran out of resources essentially in this way. So it began, again, talking about how Switzerland had done business, how Luxembourg had done business. It began leaning on its status as a sovereign nation to raise funds. One of the ways it did this was by agreeing to be part of Australia's offshore detention program. But now Nauru is looking at leasing, giving licenses to mine the seabed because it has exclusive right to about 200 miles around its borders, territorial borders. It has the right to decide what happens on the seabed. Environmentalists are really mad about this. Scientists think it's really dangerous, a dangerous precedent to set. We don't know what happens when we mine the seabed, but it is Nauru's, technically its sovereign right to do this. And so it's just doing what it can do to get by.
Right. Now, real quick, what do you see as the future of free zones?
I think that the asylum seeker bit is gonna expand. I mean, the incoming Trump administration has already said that it's looking to strike deals with Caribbean countries and Panama to take asylum seekers and refugees. you know, I don't know if they're going to say yes. There's really not a lot of good headlines about this happening. But I again, who knows what kinds of transactional deals will arise in this second Trump administration. There's also the possibility of free zones being used more widely to get around the Trump tariffs. It's, of course, in the Trump administration's power to crack down on that as well, right? Something that I didn't mention yet is that all of these free zones are very much sanctioned by the state. Like these countries know this is happening and they're down with it, right? They're doing this because it benefits them too. So I think that these next 4 years are going to be really interesting. And we may even see some innovations in this space as well.
Well, thank you very much. We just spent a few minutes with Atoussa Araxia Abrahamian and her book, The Hidden Globe, How Wealth Hacks the World. Atoussa, thank you so much for your time. We'll be right back.
Thanks for having me.
Moving. Whether it's across town or across the country, the mere thought of it gives me the heebie-jeebies. It can be stressful for people. Will my stuff be packed well? Will anything break or disappear? Finding the kinds of people you want to trust with your cherished items may have just gotten easier. We're fortunate to be joined this morning by Rebecca and Stephanie Roberts, owners of WP Moving and Logistics. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us today.
Okay, guys, you've been in Park City since what, the early 90s? Tell us a little bit about how the two of you decided that this was what you wanted to do.
Well, we have been in town for an awfully long time, and I'm not sure this is exactly what we decided we wanted to do. We sort of ended up in a situation where we had an opportunity to start to move people, so we took that opportunity and ran with it.
Okay, and like, what? How do you differentiate what you do from any other sort of vanilla moving company?
We go above and beyond the other vanilla companies. We make sure we're a white glove relocation company. So we make sure to cater to each individual and each move. Every move is different and every person is different. So we really try to accommodate all the special needs that somebody may need. And we go above and beyond to make moving relaxing and fun, which is the total opposite of what moving is.
And how many years have you been in business with this?
We've been in business we were one of the first moving companies in Park City, so well over 30 years.
Holy cow.
Holy cow.
Jeez. Okay, so let's talk about the process a little bit.
Okay.
What do you do to sort of create that, what you told me was a concierge moving experience? What do you do? Let's go through the steps, and how is it that makes the moving person who is under a great deal of stress, how do you make their life easier?
I think the first thing that we do is we sit down and we actually meet our clients. We get to know them as a person and what their special requests for their move might be. So you might need to have your kitchen set up and you might need to have dinner prepared and the slippers next to the bed. And that's exactly what we're going to do for you.
So it's seamless. So they leave their present location and they go to their new and you've rebuilt it like a movie set, exactly to look the same as home, their previous home.
Exactly.
So we like go so far as to like take pictures of people's closets that they say, I want it just the way it was?
Absolutely, 100%. We take pictures, we videotape everything so that we can put it back exactly the way it was when we left it at the old house.
That is fantastic. I've never heard of such a thing. I love it. You guys are, you know, I think we talked on the phone about moving to Aspen.
Yes.
So if I move to Aspen, you're the thing. So, and speaking of that, how far can you move people?
We can go to Aspen. We can go to New York. We can go to the UK. We can go to Mexico. We are locally based here in Park City, but we work local, national, and international.
Gotcha.
Have you actually done a move internationally where you've gone and recreated somebody's space, you know?
We have done
100%. Yes.
We have fully dedicated containers that travel across the water to a new location. And yes, we've set up homes in the UK, in Alaska. Yeah, absolutely.
And hence the side of your business that says logistics. That must be a logistical nightmare.
Right.
No,
not for us.
No, beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's, walk me through something like that. If I wanted to move to Madrid.
Okay, if you would like to move to Madrid, we have partnerships all around the U.S. and all around the world. So we would have one of our partners videotape your house in Madrid. We'd get everything that's here in Park City packed up. We'd put it onto a private container. It's military compliant. So wherever it goes in whatever port, we have full control over that container. And so do you. It shows up on your phone. We'd go through customs, easy breezy. We'd get to Madrid. We'd have the folks deliver that container to your front door. We'd unload the container, unpack everything, hang the art on the walls, make your bed, and put everything away.
And we'd ship your car as well to make sure you had a car there.
Oh, and your wine collection, potentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be categorized and put away as well.
Now, that's interesting. So wine collections that come into Utah must be a bit of a nightmare.
No.
No?
No, you just have to follow the proper channels. You can absolutely ship, climate control ship wine to Utah, to Park City. We do have subterranean storage that's appropriate for wine and for art. Absolutely, we do it an awful lot.
Okay.
So that's a segue to what some of the facilities that you either own or lease or can provide locally. I'm packing up and I can't get into my new house for a week. What kinds of storage facilities and what kind of storage options do you offer?
We have lots of storage facilities. We've got climate-controlled subterranean storage here in the Park City area and surrounding areas. And we've also got a number of warehouses in the Salt Lake area, along with various warehouses around the U.S.
And how do you run a, we always like to ask questions from a business perspective.
Okay.
I would assume this business is somewhat episodic. Some weeks are busy, some weeks are less busy. Mm-hmm. How do you do staffing?
So we are very fortunate in that some of our employees are from underserved populations, and we are also supporting those particular organizations, and some of our staffing comes from that. And we're very, very lucky. The people that work for us stay and work for us for a long period of time.
And we usually stay consistently busy. So even during those slow times, we will still get phone calls for, oh crap, I just had a couch delivered. I need you guys to take it upstairs or something along those lines. So we've managed to stay consistently busy every day.
I think part of the reason for that is we offer a really large suite of services. So mm-hmm. we do white glove moving, we've got white glove warehousing, we've got professional art installation, we've got guys that work on pool tables and shuffleboards. Like mm-hmm. I said, we receive wine, we ship cars all over the world. We have a private brokerage firm, so we can hot shop furniture from North Carolina to Park City in 4 days if you need it. So we have a really large selection of services that we offer.
Mm-hmm. And for instance, I could have my house in Madrid and suddenly say, there's this guy up in Wyoming who makes the best pool tables.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And you'll go pick up that pool table,
yeah.
ship
yes.
it over, and have someone assemble it so it's perfectly mm-hmm. level.
Yes. We're doing that right now. We have a special guy that makes these beautiful dining room tables in the middle of nowhere, Montana. Mm-hmm. And we have a family in New York that wants their table by the 17th. And so we're picking up the table and we're delivering it by the 17th so they can have Christmas dinner on the table.
Wow. And make it, set it all up ready to go.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Jeez.
And again, the way this works, I'm just trying to think about it. You offer these services. It sounds to me as though you have an infrastructure layer of your own, but then you have a bunch of contracting relationships that you've developed with trusted sources, and that's how you make this complicated machine work. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if I were going to move from Kevin's house and he was going to move, he's going to move to Heber City for some reason, would that be with your own vehicles or is almost everything leased?
Yeah, that would be with our own vehicles. And we have a different structure to our business. So we don't sub out jobs or lease vehicles. We actually have strategic partnerships. So we are partners with all of the companies that we work with. They're partners of ours and we're partners of theirs. So there's no third party services, there's no leasing, it's all completely shared and owned.
And are there other movers similar to your business around the country that you might work with? No?
In some states there are. In Texas there is, in New York there is. There's just a very few handful of companies that's similar to ours?
There's nine companies that operate the same way ours do in the U.S.
So,
and when I get to Texas, in my new move to Texas, is it going to be your personnel who are going to unload my stuff?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm going to see you here. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as you walk in your front door, you're going to see me again.
So you have a lot of Delta miles, I assume.
I have a lot of Delta miles.
How many moves do you guys do a year?
Wow.
Oh, geez. Well, this week, for instance, we have 30 jobs that we're doing. So in a week, we've got 30 jobs going. So, you know, multiply that out and there you go.
And how big is your staff?
We currently have 11 full-time people. And then to give our employees the weekends off, we have a separate weekend crew. And those are part-time folks. We've got four of those people right now.
And then you have the other people that you can bring on mm-hmm. larger jobs.
Absolutely.
You have a pool from which you can draw.
Yeah, so if we need two people for a job, we can satisfy that. Or if we need 102 people, we can also satisfy that request.
So before we go, I want to at least touch on boxing.
Oh, boxing. Yeah. Excellent. Yes.
Well, and really, this doesn't have a whole lot to do, I suppose, with your other business. But how did you get into boxing, and what kind of boxing programs do you run?
Yeah, so I went to school for physical therapy, and I used to work with MS patients in the pool. And it turns out that people with Parkinson's also do well in the water. And I did a little bit more research and got to know that population a little better. And through Rocksteady Boxing in Indianapolis, I became involved in boxing and Parkinson's, and we do a whole host of things. So we cycle, we play pickleball, we box, we do brain games. We were studied by the University of Utah for a year, and they found that through boxing and all these other modalities, the outward symptoms of Parkinson's dissipate, and they were awarded a $5 million grant based on our information to continue those studies.
So in addition to your day job, you're running, would you call it a clinic? What did you call it?
It's a private gym.
It's a private gym, okay.
Yeah, so we have, my people are the people that want to push the needle forward. So if you have Parkinson's and you want to get a little bit better, if you're an Olympic athlete and you want to cross the finish line first, if you're a mom that wants to be able to run to the car a little bit faster after her kid, those are my people.
So after a full day of moving people, you then turn around and go to your other job.
That's right. But it ensures that we are better movers because we're a little bit stronger, a little more time in the gym.
Stephanie, do you work with them as well?
I do not, no.
Okay. All right.
And do you have a second job, side hustle?
I don't. This is enough for me.
Yeah. So now where is your gym located?
It is located across the street from Park City Storage.
Where that is.
Near Home Depot. So,
over by the Sherwin Williams.
Yes, uh-huh. Exactly,
okay.
Right.
Okay, yep. So let's give people some contact information for each of your businesses.
Absolutely.
The moving company?
Yeah, you can reach out to either myself, Rebecca at WPmoving.com, or my sister.
That's Stephanie at WPmoving.com.
And the gym is called The Sweatshop, and you can find us online.
Sweatshop.com?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the WPmoving.com.
Correct.
Okay, anything else you need to touch on before we go?
No, we just appreciate your time today, and thanks for letting us chat.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. After a short sabbatical from Main Street, Tupelo is back serving up delicious classics. This time they're over on Kearns, but still helmed by Chef Matthew Harris. Joining us via phone is Chef Matthew Harris. Good morning, Matt. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks. So let's start with the Today Show that you shot on Friday. How was that experience?
Oh, the Today Show is fantastic. Those guys are great to work with. You know, it can be a little nerve-wracking traveling to New York and getting up here and thinking you're on, NBC that's seen by millions of people. But those guys are just such a good top-notch group, and they really take care of you. So it's always a super fantastic time to go to the Today Show.
Nice. And how's everything in New York?
It's great. You know, I'm going to admit it's a little bit colder here than it was back home when I left. I wish that we were getting a little bit of this weather, honestly.
It's a wet cold, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a wet cold, but it was nice. Touch right. Windy, but can't complain overall.
Cool. Now, how did the whole Today Show happen?
We were back in September when we were actually all the chefs from Park City that attended the Beard Foundation. We were going to, we actually had it scheduled then, so I'd have been in New York already. Excuse me, but that got postponed, and they called us back, and they were like, hey, you know, what do you think about coming in around Christmas time? Would that work for your travel schedule? And we you know, being just right on the cusp before ski season start, I was like, yes, we can do it. We can squeeze it in. So it actually just, it worked out great. So yeah, we were originally supposed to go back in September, but this turned out even better.
Outstanding. So. I love it. So now Tupelo. Run by, you and your wife run it, Maggie, and you originally opened on Main Street in 2015?
Correct, 2015, on at 508 Main. Yep.
Perfect, and a short sabbatical down in Midway, and now you're on Kearns, over by Wells Fargo, yep, on the corner of Monitor. How many seats do you have there?
We have over 100 seats there, so it's on one floor, so it's comparable to the original Tupelo that was on three floors. We did have quite a few more seats at the old Tupelo on Main Street, but it really works out for us being on one level. It seems to be easier to monitor and control and be guest interactive there when you have everything on one level. So it's, you know, I can't say it's working out great.
Excellent. And how many diners can you accommodate in a single evening?
Oh, several hundred.
Nice.
Yeah, several hundred. And we do often, definitely during the winter season and peak season. So
nice. And now you're a highly trained chef, as far as I know. Some big names in the culinary arts you've worked with. Are you able to mention your favorite?
Well, I have a couple of favorites, and thank you for saying that. You know, I don't know how true it is. I appreciate that. but, yeah, I do have I definitely worked with some greats out of Atlanta early in my career. Kevin Raspin, Pano Caritasis, they're big restaurateurs in Atlanta. And ended up how I got to Utah was by John George, who is a big chef out of New York, was opening at the St. Regis, and I was the original chef that was opened the St. Regis there. I since have, you know, after opening Tupelo, have actually gone back to the St. Regis as a and opened up those concepts there as well.
And good deal.
So I operate Rhyme, Brasserie, 7452, and La Stellina there.
Well, do you get any time on the slopes?
I do, you know, it's super important to me. So I make time early in the morning to get out for sure.
Nice. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I do love some skiing.
Good. Now of all the dishes you, presently serve at Tupelo, what's the hardest one to make?
You know, the real thing with, Tupelo is we try to keep our dishes super kind of straightforward, ingredient focused, and simple to prepare. If I had to pick one, I wouldn't say it's hard to prepare, but I would say it probably has the most layered ingredients would be actually the one I did on Friday with the Today Show would probably be the beef and barley, which has been it's been a definite classic and a mainstay at Tupelo since the opening, actually.
Wow.
It's just, it has a lot of technique to it. Not a lot of ingredients, but a lot of different cooking with the sauce and the barley risotto and stuff like that, and the way that we also cook the meat. So,
yeah, risotto is an experience.
Yes. This is a barley risotto, so it's a little bit of difference, but it's still, it's a slow cooking process. So
nice.
I would probably say is the most complex.
Good. And what's your favorite?
Oh, that's going to be a tough one. I'm going to be fearful to answer that one because it changes from season to season, to be completely honest with you. I could go from one thing one season, and it'd be on the menu for a while, and then that kind of change. A really good go-to, honestly, is we do the that main crab fritter And this has also been on the menu for a really long time, and we've actually brought it back in our classic category on the menu, which we added several months ago, where we revisit a lot of the classics that we've done over the years and put them on the menu. But that one, it would be probably the crab fritter with hot sauce, butter, and house pickles.
Oh, I'm dying here. I never
it's
have.
It's a little bit of bar food. You know, you can enjoy it with a crisp glass of wine or a beer, and it would go perfectly with both.
I love it. I love the fried chicken, the elk bolognese. Are those old classics?
You know, those are classics, yeah. And that we kind of saved the chicken, to be honest with you, really for the locals.
Nice.
You know, not to put anything against the tourists, but what we usually only put that fried chicken on the menu during the summer for the locals.
Oh, okay.
And then it comes off during the wintertime. And we put other dishes. The elk bolognese tends to stay on the menu all the time. That's a local and a tourist favorite.
Absolutely.
That is definitely a classic. It's a very go-to ski hearty dish. So it stays on there most of the time.
Yep. I was going to say that. After a day of skiing, that elk bolognese.
Mm-hmm.
Boy.
Yeah. And the elk sourced from a great farm down in southern Utah, so it's a local product. The mushrooms come out of the Salt Lake Valley, so we're really proud of that, you know, keeping our focus where we're trying to use as much Utah product as we can there.
And you also have a farm, is that correct?
We have a little small farm in Midway. It's on the same land that we live on down in Midway. And we produce tomatoes, squash, Swiss chard, collard greens, all out of that little stretch, as well as some carrots and radishes and things like that out of that little section of land. And we produce that all summer long. I mean, I can't say that we produce all the vegetables that are on the menu at Tupelo by any means. In conjunction with some local farms, Wrestling Aspen or Lindsay's Farm, Gracie's Farm out in Wanship. We've really, you know, during the summer, we're really, really heavy with just produce right around there. Yeah, we do produce a good bit out of Midway, but we still use a lot of other farmers with other stuff.
And do you care for the farm yourself, or do you have some people helping you out?
So I do most of it myself, as well as Maggie helps out a lot. It's a good educational piece. So we have people down from the restaurant as far as cooks and servers and stuff that like to come in and just educate themselves about where the food comes from. So we use it as an education tool as well.
So now Tupelo, we all know it from that song, and we also know it because it is a phenomenal honey.
Yes.
Are you a beekeeper?
I'm not a beekeeper, but the Tupelo honey is a very, very unique ingredient, and it's not something that is always around. It depends on the season. And I think that's really where the name came from. We want to emphasize that we really take care in the selection of products that we use and the food that we buy. And so the name kind of embodies the whole brand and the whole focus and how we source food, which in my opinion is the most important part about, you know, cooking is the ingredients that you are cooking. You know, you can try to do a lot of stuff with bad ingredients and you can get by with it, but it's much easier to, you know, spend some time sourcing really good ingredients and making those shine.
So Tupelo is down south. You know, the trees are down south, and so you have the southern flair to your food, and Utah is the beehive state. So,
appropriate. There's definitely a conjunction there for sure.
I love it.
When we came upon the name, we were like, yeah, that just fit.
Now, how about the wine list? How's your wine list?
So we have an exceptional wine list. We've had a Wine Spectator Award since 2016. So, you know, well over 300 bottles, give or take, you know, the time of year that you're in. So we have a pretty in-depth wine list.
Outstanding. And desserts?
Desserts, we offer 3 to 4 desserts daily, and those change daily.
Oh, wonderful.
I wish I could tell you some of my favorites, but those are always rotating and elevating and coming in and out, depending, especially upon the season.
For a local's tip, don't give your favorite trail on the mountain. Give your second favorite so you can keep your favorite to yourself.
Oh, you know, let's see, it's going to be hard to say, you know, are we talking mountain biking or skiing?
Oh, geez.
Skiing.
You're after my own heart. Yeah, which one?
Wow. Yeah. Well, let's go skiing. I mean, I'm probably going to have to say Stein's Way.
Okay, good one.
Yeah, I love that. I love that run. It's challenging, then it lets off, and then it's challenging again, and it's long, and it's just, that's probably one of my favorites.
And you'll be hitting that later this week when you're back in town.
I sure will be.
Favorite mountain bike trail?
Probably Sparrow. Let's see.
I'm over at the Canyons. I'm a big fan of Ricochet.
Ricochet, yeah. Yeah, I probably have ridden that one. I don't recall it. I get down to the Canyons every now and then. I usually stay up in Park City just because it's really close from the restaurant for me to just dip up there for a couple hours.
Outstanding. And anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Thanks for listening. I appreciate y'all hearing us interview and talk, and look forward to seeing you guys this winter.
Now, how can
come
they
in and say hello?
Yeah, how can they find, do you have a website for the restaurant?
Yeah, it's TupeloParkCity.com.
Wonderful. And how would people make reservations? Do they call or they do one of those online things?
No, you can go straight to the website, TupeloParkCity.com, and there will be a reservation button, or you can go to resi.com.
Okay, we just spent a few minutes with Matt Harris, chef of Tupelo over on Kearns. Matt, thank you very much. I hope you have a successful winter.
Great. Thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
Our theme music was written by Parker Swenson and is performed by Swenson, David Becker, and Tony Ellison.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.